On WFAN, it's time for Hello, My Name is Craig, our weekly candid conversation about gambling addiction. Now, here's Craig Carton.
Good morning and welcome to another edition of Hello, My Name is Craig. Craig Carton with you for the next 30 minutes of frank, open, honest conversation about gambling addiction. As always, Dan Trelauer joining us. Danny, good morning. How you been, buddy?
I'm great, Craig. How are you, man?
I'm doing well. And happy to have Dave with us today. Dave was a guest about 4 years ago on the show, and happy to have him back. Dave, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Doing well. Thanks for having me.
So let's tell a little bit of your background for those that may not remember it. First and foremost, when was the date of your last wager?
My last bet was January 6th of 2020.
All right, so you're 5 years into your sobriety and recovery. Congratulations. That's awesome.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thanks.
Let's just tell your story a little bit. How old were you when you first got exposed to gambling?
I've been around it probably the better part of my life. I used to gamble in my 20s. I'm from Eastern Pennsylvania. I used to go to Atlantic City and gamble and could do it safely. I could take a chunk of money with me. I'd go down there. I'd leave with some money. It wasn't until 2001 that it kind of took a hold as an addiction for me while I was on active duty in the Army.
Got it. Were you stationed abroad or were you domestic?
I was abroad. I was domestic and had been on orders to go to Korea early in 2001. And then, of course, 9/11 happened. I'm a month and a half post 9/11 in my first marriage with two young kids under the age of six. And here I am going to Korea for a year, separated from my family. I first got exposed to it and really got hooked on the slot machine rooms that are in overseas bases, particularly in this case in Korea.
So there are slot machines in the actual Army base?
There are. They're with their... they are behind bowling alleys. The one I first got exposed to was actually in a hotel right on the base in what was Yongsan in Seoul. Mm-hmm. And they're there to generate money for morale, welfare, and recreation to help with things like bowling alleys and trips and things like that.
Right.
So that's why they're there. But there's none here in the States.
And then what would you, without me sounding completely, I guess, virginal on this, how would it work? Would you get your weekly pay and you could sign a check over to the casino operator, or would you have to go in with cash? How did the money part of that work?
It was cash operated. So I set up a bank account when I got over there that my wife at the time would funnel money into. I would pull the cash out. And then back then they had a cash cage where you would go and you would get rolls of quarters to play quarter machines. I mean, it was old school. Drop quarters in order to play. So right. It was direct cash that I was dealing with.
And I'm wondering, when you're over there, at the beginning, I'm sure you're gambling. It's recreational. You and a bunch of the guys go out, have a couple pops, you know, gamble a little bit, bowl, whatever it might be. It's all good. Did you wind up using gambling as a way to replace maybe the boredom if there was a stretch of time where you weren't doing all that much for the service? Or were you using it, when you look back with clarity, as a way to kind of mentally hide from maybe serious stuff that you were witnessing or doing?
I'm going to be honest. I would say it was more of an escape. Because at the time when I was there, first of all, we were under a lot of stress. We were constantly preparing for something that never happened, honestly. So we were in the field a lot. Plus, I was away from my wife and kids. And at the time, my wife and I were in there was a lot of stress between us.
Sure.
So really for me, I used it more as an escape, and it wasn't with my buddies. I started off alone and I ended up alone. That's kind of how it went.
Dan, let me bring you in here on this. You know, we talk about escapism a lot on this show as, you know, we learn more and talk to more people and try to get a handle on how we process things both mentally and emotionally. Walk me through a little bit of what you've learned over the years we've done this about people that use gambling as a way to escape. It could be something as simple as a marital problem and something obviously much more dire like war. But walk me through the kind of the process of gamblers using gambling, not for, you know, the euphoria of winning and changing their lives financially, but to escape something else.
Yeah, and you know, Dave, thanks for your service. And you know, you and I both have some experience with September 11th. So hearing you say that, there certainly was a lot of escape. And you know, when a person is looking to gamble to escape, you know, we all have issues in our lives, but we don't have coping mechanisms, or we don't know exactly how to deal with those issues. And so gambling is the thing that makes us feel better. It makes us kind of alleviate those symptoms of anxiety or worry or depression or fear, and we can forget about life for a while. Just like people turn to drugs or alcohol, gambling provides that same relief. The problem is the problems start to escalate, right? And so now you're escaping one problem, and now you're creating multiple other problems. And, you know, even on the heels of September 11th, Dave, I'd be interested, like the gambling, you know, having seen that, having gone through that, now you're part of this situation and scenario where we have to defend our country. I'm sure that was definitely a factor in guys that you were around kind of using gambling to kind of cope with and escape the realities of what had just happened. Did you sense that as well?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it's a known fact that there is a strong connection between PTSD and gambling. In fact, there's a study coming out soon that's going to kind of speak more to that, about just how strong a connection there is. And having worked with people who were coming in and out of combat situations, gambling was a go-to. I mean, along with alcohol and other things, gambling was one of the primary go-tos as an escape.
How much of the gambling, and again, this is only your story, so I don't want to speak for everyone that has military experience, but I'm wondering whether it's going to the casino because you happen to be stationed in a place where there was a casino versus the amount of downtime guys have, at least from what I believe I know about military experience, and guys playing cards and maybe losing more than you could afford to lose in what should have been a friendly card game amongst the guys.
Now, you're right on target, Craig. There's a couple things at play here. And now, here in the States, it's probably more prevalent than it was back when I got swept up, because now, of course, in the States, you have access to, you know, online casino, online sports betting, and as long as you're fenced, as long as you can have access to it, there is a lot of downtime in the military, more than people realize, waiting for transportation, waiting for appointments, you know, in between things that you're doing, which is an ideal opportunity. And I actually had spoke with one person that was stationed in Iraq where they literally had a plywood room that they sectioned off where they would play poker and bet money they didn't even have. And he basically destroyed himself betting money that he didn't have access to because he was killing downtime in between cleanup missions. His job was to, after something happened out in the field and there was a combat attack, his job was to go out and clean up the area and pick up all of our equipment and do all that sort of stuff. So in between, they had nothing to do, so they would just play poker.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense to me. It's the downtime that's the killer there. For your story, and I know you wrote a book about this as well. We'll get to that in one second. For your story, I'm wondering, does there come a point where a superior officer or someone else in the military becomes aware that you have a problem or, you know, challenges you on what you're doing? Or were they completely blind to it?
No, they were completely blind. I was exposed because I ended up stealing from my own unit to support my addiction. It wasn't a lot of money. It was a small amount of money, but it didn't matter. I stole it from my own unit. Once they started the investigation, I pulled the investigator aside and said, let's go talk. And I immediately admitted to what I did because I was so ashamed of it. And even when I got disciplined for it, my commander didn't really bring up the word gambling. He talked about money issue. He talked about character issue, but didn't really use the word gambling. So, you know, there was a lack of understanding about just how powerful this addiction can be. And I think, honestly, there still is.
Yeah, one of the things I was researching when Danny told me that you were coming back on, and I'm very careful about how I present this, and Dan, please jump in on this as well, but when I was reading just about your background again to get ready for today's show, I was reading that 40% of military men or women that wind up with a gambling disorder have attempted suicide. Is that number accurate?
That what the way that it actually presents is 40% of veterans who seek help for a gambling addiction have reported at least one suicide attempt.
Wow.
And I can tell you that's true. I had four. So
you had four attempted suicides?
I did, yeah.
If you don't mind, I think it's important that we do talk about, if you don't mind talking about it a little bit, Was it
not at all?
Like, was it an emotional, like, knee-jerk reaction to a bad day, or was it something that you put a lot of thought into and planning into?
It came down to this first and foremost, is I thought nobody could ever understand what was going on in my head because I didn't understand it. I didn't understand why I couldn't stop. So it was short-term planned. So one, just as an example for one of them, I sat in a parking lot at a grocery store for 4 hours before I decided to take an entire bottle of antidepressants. Just trying to figure out how I could get help and with thinking that nobody could ever help me and that I was so lost I'd never come back. I'm just like, why am I even bothering? Why don't I just finish it and be done with it?
And let me interrupt you on that, and then we'll take a quick break and we'll continue because I think it's important we tell these stories. And Dan, we'll get you're taking this in a quick second as well. Was it because you were in financial distress? There's no way out of that. Was it shame or embarrassment at what you had done or that your kids were going to find out? Like, if you go back to that time when you're sitting in the car by yourself and about to take an entire bottle of antidepressants, was there one specific motivating factor or no?
It was honestly all of the above. I had young children that I had embarrassed myself as their father. I had used every bit of money I had and taken money I didn't have. I had alienated all of my friends, my family, everybody. It was a combination of all that.
Let me take a quick break. Dan, we'll get your voice on this as well in 1 second. This is Hello, My Name is Craig.
Back to more of Hello, My Name is Craig on The Fan with your host, Craig Carton.
Welcome back to Hello, My Name is Craig. Dan Trelawer, as always, and happy to have Dave, a American hero who represented our country for the Army. And then I assume you were dishonorably discharged. Is that fair, Dave, or no?
No, actually, I was discharged general under honorable conditions, and my commander said, you've done a lot of good things for us. You did a lot of good things, and we want you to be able to get the help that you need, so we're going to discharge you under honorable conditions. The problem is they didn't know what that help looked like, but at least they allowed me to get out and get help, which I'm grateful for to this day, because they could have done dishonorable very easily.
Dan, let me bring you in. I don't want to pay short shrift to what we did before the break when Dave was talking about 4 suicide attempts, but it's something you and I talk about a lot, and we don't talk about it enough, so I'll jump in here on that. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm still thinking about what you said. I mean, these are just the people that are coming in for treatment, right? So we know that number is likely way higher because you can only get data from the people who actually come in and look for help. And that just really blows my mind about really how much higher that number could be. And I'm glad to hear that they gave you the honorable discharge because they recognized at the time, looking backwards, like, okay, yeah, this person is someone who needs help. There was some compassion shown and they really, did a better thing. Now, to your point, what does help really look like? Because we oftentimes see that folks who return from serving our country are really left without a lot of resources. How was your experience finding help, I guess, when you came back? And how did that compare to kind of what we hear sometimes reported about veterans really kind of falling through the cracks?
It was 2 years before I finally found help that made sense. My addiction continued after I was chaptered out of the Army in 2005. It was another 2 years of going down the rabbit hole. I had gone back and forth to the VA, but they had talked to me about general family relationships and depression and anxiety. But it wasn't until one visit when a clinician reached in their desk and pulled out this old stapled packet of paperwork and literally shook the dust off it that said VA gambling treatment program, handed it to me. It didn't even make the calls for me, just handed it to me and allowed me to make the calls. Well, I made the call because at that point I was so desperate I was willing to do anything. I made the calls and finally in 2007, I found the help that I needed, but I had to do the work to get there.
Dave, there's something that strikes me as you're talking, and something I'm kind of internalizing my story as I listen to you. And that is, and Dan, we've talked about this a lot, there was a stage in my recovery for a decent period of time where I had great shame associated with what I had done. And, how gambling had led me down this bad path to then making other, bad decisions, being with bad people and all the things that, unfortunately for me played out so publicly. And then a light switch kind of went off at some stage of my recovery where I'm not proud to be an addict, but I'm proud of all the work I've done and how I'm helping my community out. And I'm no longer, I no longer feel any sense of shame or embarrassment about what I did and the bad things I did. And I sense, listening to you, that you're in the same place where whatever shame or embarrassment you had and all the emotions you went through as a bad dad, a bad husband, all those things, it sounds to me now like you've shed all that. You're in a really good place. You're proud of who you are. You like what you see when you look in the mirror. And sharing the story, it's almost like you're wearing it as a badge of honor. And I think, like, I get such a good feeling listening to you because I can relate to what I think I'm hearing in your voice. And I'm hoping I'm right about that.
What you think you're hearing is exactly right, Craig. I am so grateful to be who I am right now. And listen, I could sit here and kick around all day being how ashamed I was at what I went through. I went through what I went through. I use it as a catalyst to pay it forward and help other people. One of the things that I became was brutally honest about who I am and where I am at any given point in time.
Yep.
And that allowed me to better understand the addiction, because a lot of that addiction was hiding from myself. Now I don't hide anymore. And what an honor to be able to share it and hopefully help other people in the process. I mean, yeah, you were right on target with that.
Dan, what was it for you? What was that? I know you got a jet here in a second. What was that moment for you in your recovery? You and I have known each other a long time now, but I'm not sure if I ever asked you what that pivotal moment in your recovery was, where you went from embarrassment and shame to owning it. And again, none of us are proud of the bad things we did, but we're happy to talk about what we did now in a much different manner.
There's two things I want to mention here. There was a point in time when I got caught February 11th of 2010, where I would go back to gamble. I literally thought I was going to find a way to fit it back into my life. That day changed when I was sentenced, August 19th, 2011, and I heard my mom crying in the back of the courtroom. That was pivotal for me to know that that would be the time that now I'm changing my life and I'm not going back to it. The time when the guilt and the shame finally started to melt away was when I was working for 800 Gambler. And, you know, I was always encouraged, you can share your story, but it doesn't have to be your story. You can kind of use it like, I know somebody who, or I heard about a friend, right? We always have a friend who did something.
Right.
And that just did not feel authentic. And it didn't feel real. So I remember the time that I kind of stripped it away is when I was in front of a bunch of clinicians, training them about gambling. And for the first time, I said, I was the person. It was me. And it felt so freeing and releasing to own it. And I never looked back. And sharing that vulnerability and authenticity is key, not just to my recovery, but then to help other people feel it's okay, you know, to talk about it. And that those were the two critical moments that I remember.
That's awesome. Before I let you both go, Dave, tell me about the book.
The book's called Fall In, A Veteran with a Gambling Addiction. It begins and ends with the exact same phrase. This is a story of hope. And in between is just talking about my journey through the addiction while in the military, while as a veteran, and then what I did to find hope and get back to who I am today.
Great. One quick question, and I apologize, because I know I got to let you go. What did you use to fill the time with the void when you stopped gambling? It's one of the biggest questions I get from parents of younger guys that, you know, I'm counseling now on a regular basis. You know, you try to give a 19-year-old kid, a 22-year-old kid, some advice as to how to fill the time. And I usually revert to go for an hour-long walk, go to the gym, you know, find something to do. You know, working out's good. Read a book, whatever it might be. I'm wondering for you, when you finally committed yourself to not gambling, what did you replace all that mental space and time with?
That's a great question, because at first I had no clue. I was like, what do I do to fill this void? So what I did is I decided to make my mission figuring out what my mission is. So I explored all different avenues. I tried painting. I tried writing. The writing is actually what led me to the book. And then I realized that I found a lot of joy in wanting to help other people, so I went back to school. I spent that time going back to school to get a degree to be able to now help other people and coach other people that are struggling with gambling and help them in their recovery, and that felt meaningful to me. So I just made my mission figuring out what has meaning to me and then picking something that does that.
Well, I think it's great. You sound like you're doing great. I'm proud of you. Appreciate you coming back on the show. 11 years in the military, 5 years in recovery now, and it seems like life is on the right path. And can't thank you enough for coming on and sharing your story. And I think we need to be more sensitive collectively to our military brothers and sisters who do come back, and we can't possibly imagine the experiences you guys have had abroad, and make sure that we hug them and look out for them and get people like yourself the help that they so desperately need. Appreciate you coming on and sharing the story. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much, Craig. I really appreciate it.
Dan, I remember talking to him 4 years ago. He sounds like he's in a much better place now, and thank you again for setting that up. Any final thoughts you had?
Yeah, Dave's been great. We've stayed connected all the years, and to see him have a book to come out, it's really just a testament to the hard work he's putting in one day at a time, and to show that, once again, recovery is possible. You know, it really is, and sometimes people are listening, and they don't know where to start. You just have to start, and that's the thing. Just start.
Yeah, and, I agree with you. That's for look, I was gambling every waking minute of my life, and the fact that I've now gone more than 7 years without gambling means that anybody can do it. There's nothing special about me or you or anyone else. Like, you just got to commit yourself to recovery and wanting an easier, better style of life. And I mean, that's not hyperbole. It's just life is easier when you're not gambling, if you have a gambling addiction. And I appreciate him sharing the story. Always appreciate you. Obviously, we got another week left here in August, and then right back into it. But appreciate everyone listening, allowing us into your homes and cars to hear. Hello, my name is Craig. Dan, enjoy the week and the rest of the weekend, and we'll do it again next week.
Sounds great. Thanks, brother.
All right. Thank you so much. You are listening to Hello, My Name is Craig on Sports Radio 101.9 FM, The Fan.